morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. The federal government's attention is turning to another forum today, this time to jobs and in particular work in the manufacturing sector. It's a tough assignment. Manufacturing in Australia is losing tens of thousands of jobs each year. In the past 12 months, 11,000 textile, clothing and footwear workers have been put out of work. The Textile Clothing and Footwear Union has tracked the fate of over half the 1,850 Pacific Brands workers who lost their jobs more than a year ago. Union Secretary Michelle O'Neill has travelled to Canberra to tell their story and fight for a better deal for retrenched workers. She spoke to Alexandra Kirk.
Of the 1,193 workers who we've kept contact with and tracked since they lost their jobs, 44% as of May this year were employed, but 56% remained unemployed. And even more shocking, once you look at those who found a job, of those who are in the workforce, only 22% are employed in permanent jobs and 73% are employed in insecure or short-term and casual employment.
And do you think that's a similar story across the manufacturing sector in heavy industry, such as steelmaking, for example, as well?
Look, I think there's a particular story here that's to do with the large number of women who lost their jobs. I don't think the labour market is the same for women and men. And I think one of the great problems with what's happening in terms of assistance for the industries that are adjusting at the moment is that we don't properly address what happens. And what we know about the labour market is that the majority of short-term casual work and the majority of jobs that have been created are actually jobs that are filled by women. And so I think there's a disproportionate effect where men who are losing their jobs are more likely to be able to pick up permanent work, and women who are losing their jobs are more likely to end up in short-term, casual, insecure employment.
What will you be asking of the government at the Jobs Forum?
We've got a number of proposals we want the government to implement. We think there's some key work that can be done to support and grow the industry out of both government procurement and private procurement. Things like ensuring that governments purchase from ethical local manufacturers in the areas of textile and clothing, uniforms, carpets, footwear, etc.
And what about the people who've lost their jobs? Do you think that you can prevent the high attrition rate of those people who end up not being able to get a job again or only can get part-time work?
Look, I think we can do a lot more to assist these workers. One issue is that they are able to get some assistance in terms of help with training, but what we've found with the Pacific Brands workers is that they are in a position where they economically need to work and need to work fast. Even though they may look at and have a desire to do retraining and develop their skills, they're forced into finding whatever work is going as quickly as possible. A simple measure that could be introduced by the government that would make a real difference is a training allowance that would allow those workers to actually properly undertake vocational training, but also importantly, many of these workers need and want English language and literacy training.
The National Secretary of the Textile Clothing and Footwear Union, Michelle O'Neill. The government is hinting that today's Jobs Forum will deliver some concrete action that will mean more work for local manufacturing. The Industry Minister, Kim Carr, is speaking here to Alexandra Kirk.
I would expect there'll be specific questions addressed directly as a result of the conversations today. We cannot be complacent. Given the scale of the social adjustment that this country is going through as a result of what is the biggest change we've faced in probably two generations.
Are you trying to just stem the job losses or actually expand the manufacturing sector?
We want to see more companies form. We want to see different types of companies formed. We want to see old companies transformed. And we believe as a result of people being prepared to engage in a serious discussion about what this country has to do to be more competitive in this current environment, we can actually create more work.
Can people expect some substantial announcements from the government by the end of the day?
It's my expectation that we'll see specific matters canvassed and responded to today.
Substantial ones?
Our responses will be appropriate and considered within the available resources the government has, given how tough the budgetary situation is. There are opportunities in terms of ways in which we can address getting more local content in a major resource projects, ways in which we can ensure that there are better approaches to government purchasing policy, ways in which we can ensure that there are new investment opportunities open up as companies become more innovative, more engaged in new investment with new technologies and new business practices as a result of the development of new products.
You clearly can't mandate Australian content. Are you planning to offer incentives if Australian content is boosted?
We take the view that mandating not just shouldn't be done, but it just doesn't work. If you try to mandate, all you do is get a short-term fix without necessarily getting the commitment to change that's necessary to keep industries competitive. Whatever the percentage of local content in our major projects, whatever it is, I want to see it increased. And so there are ways that can be done without mandating. There are things that we can do as a nation to improve our economic opportunities.
What sort of things?
Well, we can ensure, for instance, that there's more innovative firms. We can ensure that there's better training. We can ensure that our companies are more competitive.
The Textile, Clothing and Footwear Union wants government and industry to buy more locally made clothing, having a more proactive procurement policy. Are you offering them some tangible hope that that will occur?
I believe that the Textile Union is playing a very constructive role through the Australian Textile Innovation Council to ensure that they do get a fair go on behalf of their members. But we also need to improve the capabilities of our local firms so they can be more competitive when they bid for defence work. And we have to be able to ensure that they do get a fair go in terms of contracts that are being issued. And we're working with all the manufacturing sectors and with the unions to ensure that that actually happens.
The Industry Minister Kim Carr speaking to Alexandra Kirk in Canberra. It seems a day doesn't go by without more bad economic news leaching out of Europe. This time it's from the International Monetary Fund, which has dropped its growth forecasts for Europe and warned that another global recession in 2012 can't be ruled out. At the heart of Europe's problems is Greece, where crippling debt has prompted austerity measures, which in turn have been met with violent protest. As Europe correspondent Philip Williams reports, there are splits emerging on how best to solve the EU's debt problems.
So, who's right? The International Monetary Fund or the British Prime Minister David Cameron, who argues now is not the time to spend your way out of a crisis?
The only way out of a debt crisis is to deal with your debts.
But on the same day David Cameron was addressing his party conference, the IMF was addressing the whole European mess and arguing that if the economies worsen, countries like the UK, Germany and France should consider delaying cuts and borrowing at low interest rates to stimulate growth. But David Cameron says this isn't a normal economic cycle and austerity stays.
Our plan is right. Our plan will work. And the vital point is this. If you don't stick with it, it won't work.
As David Cameron was speaking in Manchester, there were more demonstrations in Athens. The people here say the cuts are punitive, that the sackings, the slashed wages, the sell-offs are creating a deeper recession, which in turn inhibits the nation's very capacity to repay the loans. And now the IMF, at least in part, appears to favour that view. Antonio Borges is the head of the IMF's Europe programme.
There should be a new programme for Greece, probably different in nature from the existing one, one that will put even more emphasis on generating long-term growth.
And growth is the key word. That elusive engine of prosperity is spluttering to a halt in Europe, and David Cameron warns things might get a whole lot worse.
The threat to the world economy and to Britain is as serious as in 2008, when world recession loomed. The Eurozone is in crisis. The French and the German economies have slowed to a standstill. Even mighty America is questioned about her debts. It is an anxious time.
The risk is not contested, but how to avoid the worst of it, to cut or to spend, that is a debate that continues to divide. This is Philip Williams in London reporting for AM.
And you're listening to AM Around Australia on ABC Radio National, where it's approaching 20 minutes past 7. Internationally, we're being heard on Radio Australia, and the audio and transcripts of our stories, as well as our links to our Facebook page, can be found on our website. Just type ABC AM into your search engine and follow the links. A refugee who's been living in Australia for 10 years has been jailed by an Indonesian court after he was detained by the country's anti-people smuggling task force. Haider Ali was arrested by Indonesian police in May, travelling to Java's south coast with a known people smuggler and 32 people from the Middle East. While Australia's political leaders remain locked in a stalemate over offshore processing, the procession of asylum seekers through Indonesia's immigration detention centres continues. Indonesia correspondent Matt Brown reports from Sukabumi in West Java.
Haider Ali's large family in Western Sydney hasn't seen him in 5 months. He was arrested with a known people smuggler near Sukabumi, a key transit town near Java's south coast in May. Haider Ali says he was trying to help two cousins who'd just arrived from Iran get a boat to Australia with 30 other people, but he had nothing to do with the smugglers.
I no do business, I no do any wrong. I go with this to my family. The 5 months now in the jail.
Haider Ali's an Iraqi refugee who took a boat to Christmas Island in 2001, then resettled in Western Sydney. And he says policies like the Gillard government's controversial Malaysia solution wouldn't stop his cousins from trying again.
Because the country no good. Why they go in this way? The country no good. Iraq no good. Iran no good. They come.
Since the High Court rejected the Malaysia solution, Indonesia's anti-people smuggling task force has detained 147 would-be passengers. That's on top of more than 300 who've made it to Australia by boat over the same period. But the policy standoff over offshore processing has not had a significant effect on those numbers. Early this year, the traffic had already fallen to roughly half of last year's record high. It barely changed after the Malaysia solution was announced or after it was struck down by the High Court. The local head of the anti-people smuggling task force, Police Commissioner Fatma Noor, says it has damaged the trade, arresting senior smugglers as well as their drivers and boat crew under tough new anti-people smuggling laws. But their latest case also shows just how difficult that can be. On Monday night, Commissioner Fatma's team detained 60 new travellers from the Middle East. After we made the arrests, we found some life jackets in a car, she says. And the drivers told us they were supposed to meet small boats, waiting ready to transport them to a larger boat to make the journey. The detainees say they're just tourists who don't want to claim asylum here or anywhere else. All of them have valid passports and visas, but they've been sent to an immigration detention centre in Jakarta. After a major operation involving informants and undercover officers, they'll probably end up being released. The task force has already arrested the man who organised around 10 hire cars for the group, but with the help of the Australian Federal Police, it's still looking for the foreigner who arranged the whole affair. It's also already tracking a new group preparing to make yet another trip to the south coast. This is Matt Brown in Sukabumi for AM.
A federal parliamentary committee looking into immigration detention has spent the past 2 days in Sydney visiting Villawood and holding a public hearing. The committee has heard of the severe mental health impacts of prolonged detention, in particular for more than 40 people in Australia who've been left in limbo after receiving an adverse security assessment from ASIO. The refugees can't be sent back to their home country, and usually no third country will accept them. AM has spoken to one Villawood detainee who finds himself in this legal limbo. Barbara Miller reports.
Rahavan Yogachandran, his wife and 3 children, have a house in Villawood. They have some material comforts, but life isn't great.
It's a really hard life, you know that? It's a really hard. We have provided everything. We have a fridge and washing machine, ovens and TVs. That's a material. That's like a body. There's a body cannot function without a life. Life is a freedom, you know that?
Every time Rahavan Yogachandran leaves Villawood, he's accompanied by 2 or 3 circle guards. He says when his wife gave birth to their 3rd child in Fairfield Hospital last year, four Serco officers stood right outside the birthing room. Still, Mr. Rahavan says he has no conflict with the federal government or with Serco management, but family tensions are on the rise.
Our minds all the time is occupied with something. I couldn't understand what it is. There's a lot of crap running around in our mind, everyone's. Nowadays, I became control freak. It's difficult to understand. Sometimes I do that and don't do that. I feel like that, but I feel it is bad, but I couldn't control myself. That's why I'm told we are still living in conflict. As a person who hadn't been in the detention, he cannot understand what it is.
Mr. Rahavan says he doesn't know why ASIO gave him a negative security assessment. The 40-odd refugees in Australia in this situation have no access to that information. A recent court case to try to gain them the right to challenge the ruling failed. Mr. Rahavan was a prosperous chicken farmer in northern Sri Lanka. The area was run by the Tamil Tigers, or LTTE. He says he only had business dealings with them, but he suspects that's why ASIO didn't clear him.
According to the LTTE rule, every business people wanted to pay the tax according to their income. That's why we pay the tax for them, but we didn't have any arms involvement with them, or we didn't have any arms training.
Rahavan Jogachandran says as far as he understands, the Australian government is still looking for a third country for his family to be moved to. They've been granted refugee status. The trouble is that no one's keen to take someone Australia's deemed a security risk. Are you hopeful that the situation will change for you? Do you have hope?
I have no hope.
Rahavan Jogachandran, a refugee in Sydney, an asylum seeker. That report by Barbara Miller. Afghan security officials have arrested a group of people who they say were out to assassinate President Hamid Karzai. The suspects were detained after raids in the capital, Kabul. Intelligence agents say the alleged plotters had links to Al-Qaeda and were training for the attack. The latest arrests have increased fears and tension in the capital, which has seen a recent spate of insurgent action. Afghanistan correspondent Sally Sara reports from Kabul.
Afghanistan's National Directorate of Security says it stopped a plot to assassinate President Hamid Karzai. NDS officials called a press conference to announce that six people had been arrested. The suspects allegedly received weapons and explosives training in neighbouring Pakistan. They were also given access to a bank account containing $150,000 to finance the operation. The plot was linked to Al-Qaeda and terrorist group the Haqqani Network. NDS spokesman Laftullah Mashal says those arrested included a presidential bodyguard, a university lecturer and several students. Police and security officials say they're still hunting for more suspects. Previous assassination plots against President Karzai have failed, including an attack by militants in 2008. But the level of tension remains high. It's less than a month since former President Bernardine Rabbani was killed by a suicide bomber at his home in Kabul. Professor Rabbani was also chairman of Afghanistan's High Peace Council. His murder not only prompted questions about the level of security, it brought the peace process to a temporary halt. President Karzai announced last week he is suspending attempted talks with the Taliban and focusing attention on Pakistan instead. As news of the latest arrests unfolded, President Karzai was finishing a two-day visit to India, where he signed a security and development agreement. But he was careful not to neglect Pakistan.
I say Pakistan is a twin brother. India is a great friend.
President Karzai wants to push ahead with plans to hold talks with the Pakistani government about the insurgency affecting both countries.
Our brothers in Pakistan and Afghanistan are suffering the same violence, the same extremism. So it's only more logical that the two countries who are bearing the burden of all that violence sit down and talk and sort out the difficulties and clarify the dark areas.
President Karzai announced earlier this week he'll hold a traditional gathering known as a lawyer jirga to consult local leaders from across Afghanistan on the direction for the peace process. Until then, the relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan remains tense and complicated. This is Sally Sara in Kabul for AM.
To the financial markets, and Wall Street is closed higher after US economic data topped estimates and optimism grew that European leaders will recapitalise the troubled banks. Energy shares climbed as oil rallied on an unexpected drop in supplies. So in New York, the Dow finished up 131 points. The dollar is buying 96.5 US cents. I'm Tony Eastley. Thanks for your company, and that's AM for today.